Welcome to the Stronger Than You Think podcast. My name is Sarah Verhoff, and I'm super excited today to have my friend on, Rolando. We were just discussing a whole bunch of things, and we started having too much fun, so we thought I'd record and make sure everybody can hear. His channel's YouTube channel is Rolando Estacada. I know him as Rolando Garcia III, and so I was just about to ask him, what's the difference? Why did you name your channel that? And how do I even introduce you? So, Rolando, I'm actually just going to let you go ahead and introduce
Oh
yourself.
yeah. Well, I'm always happy to see you, and I think with all the conversations we've had over the years, and they're just so rich and very engaging. I think it's great that we can finally put this and record this, and kind of start a memorialization process of a lot of our conversations. And my channel is Rolando Estacada, and it's the name of my system of martial arts and philosophy. And in traditional martial arts, the idea is that you kind of want to name the fundamental style of it and then attach your name to it so that you can,
Oh.
it's less for the purposes of ego, but just more to differentiate it, just to be able to say it's kind of like spaghetti. I'm not making spaghetti, but this is Rolando's spaghetti. This is kind of his
Okay.
spin on the ingredients, maybe a little more, a little more bolognese, something like that. So it's basically saying this is my own way of spinning this particular sauce. And it's overarching because in many ways it encapsulates not just a martial philosophy, but martial philosophy being an entry point towards consciousness, a way of life, a way of living. And that's some really deep stuff, because if you take a look at the history of people who use the traditional martial arts throughout human history, martial arts fundamentally was for military purposes at first, not necessarily civilian self-defense. The idea of civilian self-defense didn't necessarily come in until the last 100 or 200 years. It was, but for the most part, it was like mass scale. And a lot of these people, and I think as in many ways it was also recorded, had a very, I would say, existential and even spiritual view of life, because they had a lot of skin in the game. If you put on your armor, you had your sword, and you're gonna say, well, I'm gonna, fight this duke or fight in the name of the holy something or other. It was true skin in the game. So
Yeah.
you couldn't just practice a martial art and then post it on Insta and take a selfie. It wasn't like that in those days. You there, Mr. Painter, do a selfie of me holding the sword. It wasn't like that. It was really, when you trained this, there was a good chance that you would die on the battlefield. And in those days, it wasn't like, bullets whizzing at you and then, oh, I just go into decoherence and go back into the quantum field. It was like you had several arrows stuck in you. You were still going, and then just like that Monty Python skit, oh, it's just a flesh wound, and the arm flies off, and he keeps going. That was the reality of it. So a lot of them would have practices, rituals that not just kept them strong and courageous in the face of what they signed up for, but also like fully engaged, like they were just in it. When they loved, they really loved. And if when they fought, they really fought. And if they were gonna cheat, they were really gonna cheat. They just committed 100% to these things. And estacada, the idea of it, I think the estacada is the Spanish word for thrust. And it is a technique in all swordsmanship where it is the fullest commitment. It is the most effective of all swordsmanship techniques, because basically, once you're in, you're in.
You're all in.
You're all you are all in. And but it's not just estacada with the sword. It's estacada meaning you're gonna go right into it. If you see yourself in a situation, you're gonna go right into it. And we live in a strange time where, because of what we know, advances in our technologies and our sciences, the idea of multiverses, parallel worlds, many versions of you. This idea that, well, there are many versions of me. There are other lives. I can just press the reset button on the video game and voila, I'm back into it. It kind of in a way makes us kind of non-committal. It makes us think that, well, I'll have another shot at it. But in prior cultures and in prior, in like hundreds of years prior, this was it. This was your one shot. So in many ways, the context within these warriors lived was really about the context of full engagement. This was it. This was you. This is your fate. There was a deterministic view. But nowadays, the ideas of quantum superposition, that an electron could be in many millions of universes and superpositions at the same time. Well, we kind of take that into a macro organism scale. Well, I can be in superposition too. I can live on a spectrum. I'm not just one thing. I can also be another thing. And we find this, and this is how I weave these kinds of things. I think that's why we find ourselves in the society that we're in today, not only in terms of our intellectual proclivities, but even our political tendencies. On the way, that's why we find ourselves contradicting ourselves, even in our own politics, where we'll say something like, "Well, I'm for this policy." Yeah, but you voted for this person who's against that. Yeah, well, this podcaster or YouTuber said this, and then round and round in a self-referential loop we go. So I think that the name Rolando Estacada is kind of, in a way, a throwback to that age of, this is who you are, this is what you're doing. There's a locality to you. There is no other version of you that exists somewhere. You're not living in a simulation, which is all over social media now. What timeline am I on? What simulation am I in? Who's running this simulation or this computer program? No, this in medieval times, or one of my favorite subjects of study, Japanese military history. This is it. You're not going anywhere. This is you. You once you're a samurai, that's it. Once you're a farmer, that is it. And you're gonna live your life like this. There is no other choice. And it's a throwback that Rolando Estacada is this idea of full, engaged, committed living. That's the idea.
Awesome. I love that. That's super cool. And while you were talking, I don't know if you saw me, I'm over here taking notes,
Oh, I
writing
saw.
things down, and I'm loving it. And the sun's shining right on my face. So
That's
whatever. I'm in
awesome. That's the
Florida.
sun saying hi to you.
The sun is just like, hey, yeah, I want to join in too. That's my way of living is in the sun. That's why
I
I'm
love
in
it.
Florida.
And I'm envious.
I know. Give me all the sun. I'll try and bounce some of it back on you. So it's interesting, as you were talking, all of a sudden I realized like you're the first man I've interviewed, which is interesting because and this is actually the first time that we've like seen each other's faces face to face. Like we've done a lot of phone conversations. And I mean, I don't know if you've stalked me online and seen me, but I've stalked you a little bit online and I've seen you, but
I've stopped you.
I hear your
I
voice
know
and I
you.
feel your energy. So like we know each other very, very well. It's really cool. So I was just thinking, like, I think you're my 25th or 26th podcast episode and you're the first man. So that's kind of fun. So
Wow.
yeah. So congratulations and thank you for
Thank
being here
you.
and all of that. And I loved hearing that it felt like everything you said came back to like this intentional living
Yes.
and not a whole bunch of resets. And it was interesting what you said about the video games is I think everything is so non-committal because there's always a do-over. And so when you think there's always a do-over, you're never really fully committed to anything. And so the very beginning of all of this, you said it was like the way of living. Martial arts was a way of living. It wasn't a side hustle or anything. It was the way. And I love that you've kind of brought it back to that's how you are doing what you're doing is this very intentional way of living. And I mean, ever since we've met, I've known you to be exactly that way. So let me ask you, because you started this YouTube channel and this martial arts, like, I mean, you can describe it a little bit better exactly what you do, but not very long ago. And I'm curious because I've known you in very, what's the right way to say it? Like a lot of different roles.
Yeah,
And this was
different
more
industries.
kind of your own, not secret, but maybe sort of sacred thing that you had. And so I'm curious why, through all of these other different things, you decided to to sort of put that special thing out there?
It was a there was a pragmatic reason for it. My two main instructors, I've had many coaches in my progress and in my development, but my two main instructors, my father and my instructor Armando Basulto, both asked me, you have to teach, you have to pass this on. You can't just hold on to this. We can't have it that, everybody dies, and we don't want it so that when you die, all of this knowledge is gone.
Wow.
So they
That's
were,
a lot of thinking forward. That's really cool. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. In fact, let's have this dialogue. Interrupt anytime. But then, I was asked this in 2017, and at the time, that's when I asked them, is it okay for me to name my practice and my system Rolando Estacada? Because if I just took what my father taught me and what my instructor Armando taught me, then I would have to name it after them and constantly refer it to them. And it would be a disservice to the student who's dealing with me, because at some point, when you're having that kind of dyad with that person, like in person, it's really annoying when that person, the great grandmaster, the great wazir on this side here said this. And then he said, yeah, but what about you as a person? And, I've run into those kinds of instructors, and sometimes it can be kind of a deflection strategy. Well, that's what he said, right? You're never engaged. And so as an instructor, I had to put my own stamp, so that's why I asked them, is it okay for me to call it Rolando Estacada? And we see this throughout martial arts history. Like one of the great martial arts instructors, Antonio Illustrissimo, the system that he had is a Filipino Kali, and he named his style Kalis Illustrissimo. There's a Tai Chi school here in Manhattan, and it's the grandmaster there is a William C.C. Chen, and he doesn't call it Tai Chi, he calls it Chen Tai Chi, meaning it's his, it's coming from him. So that
That's so cool. It makes me think of like this is super simple, but like a recipe. You know, like
Yes.
you have a recipe that's passed on and you do it almost exactly the same, but then there's your little twist. Like you said at the beginning, like with the spaghetti or whatever. And it's fascinating because that's what makes you marketable is the right word, but also the wrong word. That's what makes people seek you out is because of the you in it. It's
Yeah.
the big thing, but it's the way you do it. It's your flair, it's your touch. So that's really, I love that you add your name in it. I mean, like literally, I'm writing down over here, oh my gosh, what is in a name? Because it's so much more important than I think we give it credit for. So I love this. This is so beautiful.
And with the recipe, that means the idea is that I'm not passing on my recipe for you. It is, no, you got to come up with your recipe now. One of these days it'll be Sarah Estacada or Bob Estacada or Marcus Estacada. But it's still gonna have the same components that makes it a particular recipe. And but the pragmatism came when, of course, I live in Manhattan in New York, and rent is sky high. And having worked in brick and mortar health and fitness for so long, in terms of, as a general manager managing profit and loss statements, you're not really seeing the margins once you're in brick and mortar. So in order for me to get the word out without necessarily stretching myself thin financially, I thought, YouTube. And it's so interesting when we hear about just the extensive disengagement of many people in society throughout the world globally. They don't know what to believe in. They don't know what they want. There's a sense of they don't know what to do, what to believe in, who to follow. They don't believe in themselves, when we are in fact living in a golden age of information and knowledge that is living on platforms that are far more accessible than ever. There was a time when books was just not a thing. Books were banned. In fact, the only books that you had in the Western Hemisphere somehow revolved around the Catholic narrative, right? The Judeo-Christian narrative. Anything outside of that that questioned, well, all right, so does the sun revolve around the earth or the earth revolving around the sun, any knowledge outside of that was not just not encouraged. In many instances, it was banned. But we are now living in this time where we do have access to a lot of this.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, brick and mortar, maybe not a thing from a cost prohibitiveness standpoint. Books, maybe, but in terms of accessibility and digestibility, this is the way to go. You can be on your phone, you could be anywhere, you don't have to set aside reading time, pick up your feet, light the fire, have a pipe, and read your book. No, you can be anywhere you want. Rolando Estacada has a new episode. And interestingly, the way we learn now is very different because of this technology, because in the old days, if I wrote a book, maybe in the 1950s, it was just that book.
Right.
And it was in order for you to cross-reference anything in terms of bibliographies or even just looking up a word was time-consuming. Nowadays, you can just click on YouTube. Wait, what is that term? What did he just say? Pause.
I know people say research now, and I'm like, you don't. No, you're not doing it right. It's far too easy. That's not research.
It's got to be hard, right?
I know, you got to go. You have to physically go somewhere and
that's right.
Look through the card catalog.
Yeah, the Dewey Decimal System. You know that whole thing. Like, and then you got to go and find it yourself, and then you go to the librarian. Hey, it says it's here. It's not here. And then you got the librarian's like, shh. And then they got to go. The whole process.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is just trying to find out the etymology of a word that Rolando Estacada used, and then you find out it was the wrong use. Now you got to go back to the comments. So trolling is not what it used to be, right? It's
right
now. But the point being that our ability to learn now is so digestible, so easy, and so quick. But the reason why I emphasize Estacada, the thrust, meaning swordsmanship, as you can see in the background, this is the background of my channel, all of these Japanese swords, is that it is, in my opinion, swordsmanship is the only martial art that you can practice on your own effectively. There's a lot of questions around, well, why are you training in swordsmanship? That's like the most unrealistic thing in the world. Okay, so what is realistic? Learn Brazilian jiu-jitsu, learn how to box, learn Muay Thai. In order to do that, you need a partner.
Mm.
And you need a partner who is as aligned with your goals so that they don't hurt you or injure you in any way, as you are with theirs. And finding a good partner nowadays is a very difficult thing. So your practice is hampered by the fact that you don't have a quality partner. I mean, we have a hard enough time finding a quality partner anywhere. So now you're going to trust your body to somebody who's like, hey, you look pretty cool. Let's do a little jiu-jitsu.
Let's get some swords together.
Yeah, let's get some swords together.
But throw them around.
The thing about swordsmanship is that even historically, the majority of practitioners practiced solo because they had to familiarize themselves with the tool first so that the sword, the soul of the samurai, is at one with who they are from a biomechanical perspective, but also from the perspective of awareness, autonomy, agency, intention, and manifestation. So it wasn't just this thing that could possibly hurt you, but then it became this very spiritual thing. In fact, in Japan, a lot of the Buddhist monks, who wandered around, they actually came from samurai lineages.
Really?
They had samurai training. They had swordsmanship training because you only had, once you were born into a samurai lineage, you only had a couple of job opportunities really when you were done. It's not like they had samurai LinkedIn back in the day. Yeah, you couldn't just go
samurai LinkedIn.
No, this isn't for me.
There's no scrolling.
Right. And say, oh, apply now. You can't, that's how it worked.
Yeah.
You only had two options. You either became really a samurai in terms of from a military standpoint. So you held a military position within your family's tribe,
right,
and you were the heir. So not only were you in governance and administration, but you went to war with the next fiefdom. You were it. Like, you led that, right?
Yeah.
Right. Or you were like, not my thing. I'm going to go be a Buddhist monk. and immerse myself traditionally not only in the classics of philosophy in the Japanese sense, but there were certain instances where they went back to the motherland. And at the time, what was considered the motherland was China. So they would
Really?
study with them. And so what became Zen Buddhism in Japan and how it penetrated Japanese culture was really these communications between Japanese Zen Buddhist monks who knew how to talk to the samurai. Because my brother, I grew up just like you. I went through
Yeah.
the same practices, so I know what hardships you're going through. And man, there's a lot of romanticizing of the samurai way of doing things, especially with anime and in the movies. Like, you get to walk around in cool armor. Yeah, that's cool in a movie, but imagine that that was your daily life. Like, you just walk around in a kimono all day. You can't check your Facebook. And Netflix and chill. Like, everything was so rigid. So a lot of them, yeah, it was very rigid. Like, you're not only was your day arranged, the majority of samurai, especially after the civil warring period, the Sengoku Jidai afterwards, it was called the Edo period. It was like about 150 years of peace. A lot of them were really just administrators, and to a certain extent, served a lot of accounting functions. Like, what did you do today, oh Lord so and so? Well, we have this much rice, and we have this much vegetables, and this is how much we got from the farmers. So we should be okay for winter while carrying two swords, which was illegal for them to use. So for many of them, the shogun's edict of learn how to paint, learn how to write haiku, for the shogun's purposes, kind of kept them in line. So rather than declaring another civil war, it was like, hey, you only get to be a samurai and get a stipend from me if you learn haiku, you learn bonsai, making
Your
sure you
tree.
take care of your own little plant, the tea ceremony, among other things, because he felt it pacified them. But some samurai took it really engaged in it. Like, this is who they became. And D.T. Suzuki, who is the foremost author of Zen philosophy in the 20th century, marveled in one of his books, I think it was called Zen and the Samurai, marveled about the kind of people it must have created, because those were the two extremes of human existence as far as D.T. Suzuki was concerned. On the one hand, it was absolute life and death. You must determine and qualify and quantify your existence. And then on the other hand is warfare. Those are two separate things. And we tend to confuse warfare with the matter of existence, when in fact, the matter of existence, the most difficult part, is what Zen asks you to do. Hey man, that whole thing about you being a badass samurai and you're carrying like some sort of 800-year-old sword and you get to walk around being cool, that's not it. Sit down. Sit down. Breathe, and we're going to time you for 30 minutes. And then at the end of that 30 minutes, we're going to ask you a really dumb question. Like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? What do you do when you see the Buddha come down the road? What is mu? If they ask you like really nonsensical questions, because nowadays, especially in the book Zen and the Brain by James Austin, who is both Zen practitioner and neuroscientist. What they were really trying to do with those dumb questions called Japanese koans was to kind of short circuit your brain. Because in Zen philosophy, they felt that the brain and thoughts themselves, the very idea that there's a thought that springs into your brain, is what prevents you from getting into coherence and integration with actual reality. You have a thought
Interesting.
about reality first. And then we know this now in physics. We know this now that what you're seeing is some sort of interpretation of the brain. It's
Yeah,
not
absolutely.
seeing the real thing. In fact, there's a short delay because, in fact, you're not seeing it instantaneously. There's a short delay because light still has to travel to your brain and still be, hold on, and still somehow be interpreted by your brain. So a lot is lost when you do this. So the Zen thought process is, if you want to really be in the now, there has to be a way to short circuit the brain. There has to be less reliance on thought. And the reason for me, why I focused on swordsmanship, is because swordsmanship is the only practice I know where your thoughts will disappear if you're doing it correctly, because the sword is too fast. Your eye actually cannot register it if the technique is done correctly. And that's for you, the feeder. You're the one feeding the sword, like you're moving with it from a biomechanical standpoint, but also as the receiver, like if you're on the receiving end of shinai, which is a bamboo Japanese sword, it is so fast. Not only does it the information not register in the eye, it doesn't register in the brain. You get hit. And this is the absolute reality that Zen monks wanted the samurai to experience, but in a less costly way. In a way that you, because you will meet this moment. You will at some point. You know, you're going to die. But let's see how you can master yourself and meet this moment and still somehow live to talk about it. And that's what's so compelling about the Zen practice, because as a branch of philosophy, meaning it is dealing with consciousness, but it is also dealing with the matter of reality. It is the one practice where it tries to deal with the big question that the two other subjects that deal with reality deals with, mathematics and physics. But mathematics deals with analytic, formulaic stuff that doesn't necessarily interact with reality. Physics starts to deal with particles, some matter, some of reality where there's an interaction. Mm-hmm. Philosophy deals with the one thing that could kind of gunk up the whole thing: consciousness. Mathematics doesn't deal with consciousness. Physics doesn't deal with consciousness. In fact, physics calls it the consciousness problem. You know, all of this would be a nice, beautiful, formulaic universe if it weren't for the fact that there was a conscious observer involved.
Because we could just get out of the dang way, it would be fine.
Yeah, well, if we could get this out of the way.
Yeah. You
know, but there is, we don't even know if consciousness is a fundamental feature of the universe, or if it is emergent. In other words, we don't know if the universe is an emergent property of consciousness, or if consciousness is an emergent property of the universe. We don't know. We don't have that.
So essentially, it's which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah,
bigger words, yeah. Right? Yeah.
But through the practice of Zen, the Zen monks, especially when they caught the imagination and made them the captive audience of the samurai, produced these kinds of individuals because they were dealing with warfare. So they were dealing with life and death as part of a daily basis. But Zen philosophy made them deal with existence itself. Mm-hmm. Because in warfare, the algorithm worked. Well, I'm dying for my lord. That's what I'm doing. Yeah. I'm a samurai, and I go and I die for Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, Okugawa, whoever. Yeah, but that's all fine and dandy. But what about your existence? What if you don't die? What if you have to live?
Yeah, then what?
then what? How do you just? What if your lord dies?
Yeah.
Now what do you do, right? So what are you while you are here right now? And it produced this kind of practice and point of view, according to D.T. Suzuki, which created these kinds of individuals who could be so, so incredibly brutal in their warfare, but could express these amazing pieces of humanity. You know, the tea ceremony, I just learned this, was a practice at times during warfare where sometimes they would just take a break because the fighting was just so fierce. Yeah. That both armies would actually meet like right in the middle, like within feet of each other. Okay, it's been a long couple of days. You know, let's do a tea ceremony. And they would do a tea ceremony in the, like, surrounded by all of this death. And they would preserve this sense of humanity and this sense of beauty in the midst of all of it. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think this was recorded between two of the greatest samurai lords, daimyo, in Japan, Uesugi Kenshin and Lord Takeda. And apparently they fought so many times back and forth. They were so brilliant. It was a stalemate. It was like Fischer Spassky all over again, just fighting, fighting, fighting. Those are chess players, by the way, over and over and over. But then eventually, I think Takeda died of old age. And you'd think Uesugi Kenshin is like, finally, you know, that mother, blah, 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 like, I won. Apparently, he wrote a death poem for him, if I'm not mistaken, and reportedly wept. Reportedly.
He's like, well, now what?
Yeah,
Now what do I do?
because now, because he had, they had so much mutual respect for each other. Not only could they celebrate a tea ceremony in the midst of all of this, but also when they were fighting, they understood that that was not the explicit reality. That was the implicit reality. We're just samurai because we're playing out this shadow play the way Shakespeare said it. Because
Yeah,
born
that's
into
our
this,
role.
what else are we going to do? But they knew that there was this other implicit reality underneath it. They were both Zen practitioners, both devoted Zen practitioners. So they knew that there were other layers of reality, and that's what they engaged in. And that's what I why I focus so much on this aspect of martial art, because as much as many of us feel a little disengaged from our roles in lives, you know, it's like, why do I gotta pay this bill? Why do I gotta get up at 5 in the morning? Oh my God, you know, my kids, I gotta go do this. It's like, and then you sit down and watch Netflix. This is such a dumb movie. Like, so every moment of your life is not so much a disappointment, but another piece of the sampling, the data sampling that says that of disengagement. So this is why when we have so much, no matter how much affluence we have, no matter how many millions we have or how much we have accrued, it's that strangely the explicit order, you know, what we're seeing on the surface, just like these samurai, we somehow can't take it seriously. But I think the reason why we can't take it seriously, at least our culture and our society, is because we're not engaged in the implicit order, like what's actually running, what's the actual operating system. We don't have a practice that allows us to introspect. We don't have a practice that allows us to just turn off the brain and not live in the world of thoughts. In fact, we're covered in thoughts. We're covered in it. You know, we see a notification on Facebook. Oh, I gotta see that. And it's, and, you know, some another thing that some other meaningless thing. So we're surrounded by thoughts and we're surrounded by meaningless information. And we wonder why we are so disengaged, not just from our communities, but also from ourselves. And I've found for myself that the practice of swordsmanship really helps me and even some of my clients and students just dial in to that implicit operating system. Musashi believed that a lot of it originated in the heart. In fact, in a lot of his writings, he talks about, you know, I can't put into words. He wrote the Book of Five Rings, and he's considered the greatest samurai that ever lived. And he, in one of his chapters, he says, I can't put into words the way I know this art and science in my heart. So he's not talking about a physical skill. He's the way I know it in my heart. So it's beyond the brain, it's beyond thought, it's something deeper. And that's the part I think that a lot of people in our society, in our daily lives, and you know, I think you're and your audience being a part of that also, we are suffering from a level of disengagement. And I think a lot of that has to do with, well, if the explicit stuff is meaningless, but the implicit stuff we're not connected to, then it's all meaningless. But the samurai figured something else out. This is meaningful. Me fighting you is meaningful because you and I have a subtle understanding that underneath it all, there's something else running it that's beyond thought, beyond this realm of existence. And I think that's subjective. I don't think that's something that I can pass on to anybody, or you can pass on.
Right.
Pass on.
Yeah.
It's a very deep subjective experience. And I think that the challenge for us, I think this was J.D. Krishnamurti who said it. The challenge for us is that in this next phase of our development is our advancements in wealth, advancements in nations, and advancements in technologies will be superseded by the dire impetus for advancements in spirituality,
Yeah.
our deeper core spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's cool that I was going to ask you like what your entire purpose was in creating this, you know. I mean, besides the we don't want, you know, the martial art, the thing that you know that you're so good at to die when your mentors have died, so you need to pass it on. But it sounds like your purpose is to bring engagement back, and it makes me think of like one of my very favorite things. So when I went to massage school 25 years ago, 26 years ago, they used this word and they called it beingness. It's not a real word, it's a made up word, but it's the same thing. It's the essence. That's how I go into a massage. That's how I go into energy work, is I'm not thinking. It's just, it's feeling, it's being at the same time. And I feel like when you're teaching about a sword, it's now just an extension of you. It's not me and this thing that I think about. It's almost this dance of a now I'm bigger, now I'm longer, now I have more ability to move, and it's really who you are. And it's this beingness idea that I love so much, because you cannot disengage when you just are, but it's not a conscious thing to think about. So it's beautiful. I love.
It's not. In fact, have you ever seen somebody so engaged with their treadmill? I mean, you and I have worked in health and fitness. You've
Yeah.
never seen someone just engaged with a treadmill. Like, this
Right.
is my treadmill.
Yeah.
My treadmill and I are one. And
Right.
I get spiritual meaning out of this. You know, there's no it's there's no such thing as you have a spiritual connection with your dumbbell or
Right.
your barbell. And
Yeah.
we know this
Well, with
already.
the musical instrument, like that's where that you'll see someone like tickling the ivories, and you're like, oh my gosh, I almost feel like I'm seeing something that's very intimate and I shouldn't be there. Not like in a bad way, but it's so beautiful. I mean, like you live close there to Juilliard. I've seen Juilliard performances, and there aren't words. Like you have to experience, because it's so different than like I'm sitting down to play the piano, or I'm sitting down to play this instrument. It's this dance, this extension again of someone when they're so engaged. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, you're dealing because those musicians are dealing with vibration and frequency,
Yep.
which is energetic,
Yep.
which is part
Which is what
of
you and I both do,
what you
right?
and
With
I
our
are. You know,
own.
it's you're dealing
Yeah.
with energy, and
Yeah.
you know, and again, speaking of emergent properties, you know, vibration and frequency begets energy. And from my understanding of it, if you take a look at the nucleus
Yeah.
of an atom, the forces that are holding those atoms together, the mass of it, if in fact in relation to the actual energy, the majority of that nucleus is actually energy.
Yeah.
It's one. It's a the thing. The energy that holds the nucleus together is called the strong force. So you have gravity, electromagnetism, the weak force, and the strong force. So gravity, for instance, like if I want to defy gravity, I can just pick up this cup. But it's going to take an atom splitter to split a nucleus, because that energy is a strong force. It's like it's
Yeah.
really packed in there. And that's what the majority of us are. We're majority energy. You, me, everything that's around you. Somehow our brain is wired to kind of take this all in as. We are apparently an 11-dimensional brain. We have the capacity for 11 dimensions, but we see and assess this world in only 3 dimensions, right? But we think in terms of 2 dimensions, meaning the earth is flat. We think it's flat, right? We experience it flat.
Right.
But by the time you're a musician, you're dealing with vibration, frequency, and which creates harmony.
Yeah.
And Michio Kaku, who's a physics professor, said puts it together. He said, well, vibration creates the subatomic particle, the frequency creates the actual atoms and particle, and all these other forces of the universe creates the harmony that is life, that is the universe. And music is a way, subjectively, I'm not saying Michio Kaku said this, but music is a way for us to experience this deep, orderly harmony that is actually running through the universe. Famously, Einstein was also a violinist.
And I don't think I knew that. That's cool.
He was a violinist. And then another, this one's a fictional character, Sherlock Holmes. He was a violinist. And he said that, you know, because you have three of the great composers, you have Bach, you have Mozart, and you have Beethoven. He enjoyed the harmonies of just the universal order that you experience when you listen to Bach. He said, Mozart is cool, but my God, he just goes in so many ingenious directions. And he said, Beethoven is too personal, which is true. Like if you listen to Moonlight Sonata, you're just, you know, who did you fall in love with and broke your heart? You know, shame on her, right? But Bach, when you listen to Bach and you just sit there, you could be anywhere. It is the one piece of music that doesn't necessarily transport you, but you feel absolutely in an orderly place wherever you are when you listen to Bach.
I feel the same way about Pink Floyd.
you listen to Pink Floyd, right? Whoa, you go into all kinds of places. Yeah. Sinatra, all of a sudden, you're like in the 1940s.
Right, yeah.
Right? You listen to the Beatles, all of a sudden you're in Camelot Kennedy era.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You listen to Def Leppard, you're in eighth grade, like you're always being transported by music. Bach is the only piece of music I've experienced where wherever I happen to be, you know, I could be in Florida where you are, I could be on the beach, I could be at a Barnes & Noble, you're just there and somehow everything sounds and feels very orderly. And that's what Einstein liked about it. And I think that's where musicians, why they're so engaged, not only with the instrument, but also with the music they're playing. It's because there's a sense of coherence, harmony. It was said, I believe, by Richard Feynman, when a particle is in superposition, and then when that particle comes into this universe, it coheres. And then the other particle decoheres into another universe. Bach keeps us in this universe. Music keeps us in this universe. When that person who's on the recumbent bike and he's sitting back and he's got the news on TV, he's got his phone and he's got the New York Post, not only is he covered in thought, he's anywhere but here. He's anywhere but in his body. And what that's done, the culture of multitasking and overachieving has done, is that we are disengaged not only from the moment, we are also disengaged to fundamentally who we are.
That's interesting. You've seen me, I'm sure, taking lots of notes. It was interesting because I was thinking the opposite of being disengaged was being engaged. But I wonder if, and maybe not the opposite isn't even the right word, but maybe the antidote or the... the fix or the whatever is harmony.
Harmony.
And I thought that was beautiful. I had never thought of it that way before, but that makes sense to me. When everything is sort of right with the world, it's that harmony. It's not that there's distraction is gone or hardships are gone or anything is gone. It's that they're all sort of playing nicely, at least where you are and you're in it and you're feeling it and you're aware. Rolando, it is like we've talked as fast as we could for like 55 minutes. I don't even understand where the time went. So we're gonna wrap this up and we're gonna have to do this again. I mean, we don't have to. But I love it. This is fantastic. It's wonderful. If you could leave our listeners, our viewers with one thought, if something my husband and I, so we teach a class together. And one of the things we always like to say at the very end is therefore, what is the purpose? Why did I, you know, why did we all, I'm not going to say waste our time, but why did we spend this time together for 55 minutes learning and talking about everything from swords to energy, to music, to armies, like to Buddhist monks. We talked about everything.
Yes.
Like what is one takeaway? What's the takeaway, the whole purpose, if you could say like one thing that you hope that people either hear or feel I mean, like I've already am feeling one, but I'm curious what your one takeaway would
I'll
be.
give you, if I may have 2 minutes here. This was something that Brian Cox recently said on a podcast, where he said that, and Brian Cox is a famous physics professor. He said that, you know, what we are really experiencing, what we're seeing in this universe, be it with Big Bang theory or inflationary theory, that's a new one. The idea is that it was a system that started very small, and then once it exploded or expanded, fundamentally, what we're looking at is we know what the end is. The universe at some point is going to die. What we are seeing really is the slow motion death of the universe. So that's a bit heavy. But then he did say, but in the process of this inflationary period, which ultimately will lead to the death of the universe, somewhere in the next hundreds of trillion years, the universe is only 13.7 billion years old. It created stars. And the death of stars created the elements that you and I are now made of. And what you and I are now made of in this human species was able to create the kind of violin sonatas that we hear on Mozart, or the kind of films that we now see. We are capable of empathy, deep feeling. We are capable of searching for deep meaning. So even in this great operatic death of the universe, it was able to create all of the joys of what being alive is. So if anything is going to engage us in the moment that we are in now, because we are so afraid of dying, remember that the entire universe, in the process of dying, was able to create this amazing symphony and fabric of humanity that brought us music, emotion, love, and who we are today. So do not be afraid of death. See what you are capable of bringing into this fabric of the universe that will make it extra special and meaningful for you and for everybody.
Awesome. I love it. Symphony of humanity. That's beautifully put. I love it. Rolando, thank you so much for
Thank
coming
you.
today.
Thank
Oh my
you.
gosh, this is so fun to see each other's faces finally.
Yes.
And not just hear each other over the phone, but see each other's faces. Absolutely love it. This has been amazing. And as I always end my walkie-talkies along with my podcast is that remember, I'm walking with you. Rolando and I are walking with you in this journey and the symphony of humanity, as he called it. It's beautiful. And we are just so excited and want to remind all of you and all of us, including Rolando and myself, that we're stronger than we think. And we've come through so much and look the beauty we can create. And especially when we're in this harmony and we stop the disengagement and figure out how to be harmonious in our lives and just enjoy it. So thank you again, Rolando. It's been amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Well, we'll see you later.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye.